Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a budget year with a predicted $1.3 billion shortfall, today is a major day in the Oklahoma legislative calendar. It's the last day, ostensibly, that the legislature can consider revenue bills. So far, very few bills have passed that have narrowed the budget gap for the coming year. So what is going on through the minds of legislators today? Today, we hear perspective from Steve Lewis, the former state House Speaker who served in the legislature from 1981 to 1993 and was the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Oklahoma from 1993 to 2000. During Lewis's tenure as Speaker, the state passed the landmark education bill, House Bill 1017. He joins us today from the state capitol. Steve Lewis, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Today, ostensibly, is the last day for the legislature to consider revenue measures. What's likely going through the minds of the leadership and the legislators today on this allegedly last day, although it looks like they'll be going into the weekend?
Well, I suppose they're in a little bit of a state of, I don't want to use the word panic, but, time has basically run out on them. I think they maybe misjudged a little bit the timing that was needed to really get some of these tough issues resolved. It seems like they spent a good amount of time earlier in the session behind closed doors discussing what the possibilities were, and maybe they didn't bring the membership along quite as early as they could have. And now they've gotten down to a deadline, and some of the ideas that seem good when you talked about them aren't so good out in the light of day when people are having to cast votes. So it's a problem.
Now, by my estimation, I think we'll see more use of revolving accounts and rainy day fund. But putting that aside, I'm only looking at it seems like about maybe $125 million, maybe $150 million. I'm thinking of the earned income tax credit, the marginal well cap on the credit for marginal wells. That's maybe what, $150 million of savings, if that, maybe?
I think that's right, and I'm not sure what they did to the marginal well cap bill. It was amended in the House, which means it has to go back to the Senate, and I'm not sure what the effect of the amendment is. But I think you're right. The revenue measures that they've talked about all along have really not materialized in any big way. Every little bit helps when you're trying to patch the budget together like they are. And if I were to guess, I would think that the big argument at the end here is going to be over the size of the bond issue because, of course, they had never reached agreement on it to start with. But
this would be the transportation bond, moving transportation, bridges and roads out of the budget and bonding those expenditures.
Exactly, and then freeing up that money to be used for the rest of the budget. And usually by way before this, you've had a big press conference where the leadership and the governor have come and announced that they've reached a budget agreement, and then they go out and usually have pretty good success at passing all the bills that it takes to implement that budget agreement. We haven't even had that announcement yet. There has been no agreement, and one of the hang-ups, I understand, has been the size of the transportation bond issue. And it just seems to me with some of these revenue ideas going down the tubes like they have, that bond issue is going to have to be larger rather than smaller.
You mentioned that the governor and the Senate and House leadership have not come together. It seems like there's also a disconnect between the leadership and the rank and file.
Definitely. It's been a little bit of a different session in that regard when the leadership is losing bills in the Joint Appropriations and Budget Committee and even on the floor sometimes. And I think that may be, I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, a couple of things. One, as I mentioned earlier, I think they waited a little late in the day to open up the discussion with everyone to really find out where people were. Probably things happened that I don't know about. I mean, obviously they did. But even taking that into account, it seems like they were a little bit slow in bringing everyone in. And then, again, the fact that they never have reached, usually you can sell these ideas better when you can go before your membership and say, look, we've negotiated this with the House or with the Senate and with the governor, and we would have liked to have done this, but we couldn't. They wouldn't agree, and people generally understand that, and they realize that someone has to make these decisions, and they'll go along. But at this point, it doesn't look like that's happened yet, where even that kind of statement can be made. So it makes it difficult to get out on the floor or in committee and sell these ideas to the membership.
Let's talk about one of the revenue measures that did go down in the last day or so, and that is the $1.50 a pack cigarette tax. Here you had the governor on board, you had the leadership on board, but the rank and file rejected it. In fact, here you have veto-proof majorities in both chambers, and you had House leadership asking the Democrats to vote for this.
Right. It takes a 75% majority to pass a tax increase under our Constitution. So they would have had to have, you know, if every single Republican voted for it, they would have had to have still have five Democrats. But that's different than needing 25 Democrats. And the problem was that, you know, that we've got about as much of a one-party state, as you mentioned, that as you could have. There's still not enough for the 75% supermajority, and there's just not much practice here at negotiating between the two parties, and they just couldn't get together.
Do you expect to see that cigarette tax come back up? Because that's sort of essential for preserving Medicaid in the state.
Well, they've said that. They tied the cigarette tax to the Medicaid, I suppose, in order to give people a good reason to vote for it. But if they don't pass the cigarette tax, they're going to have to find some money to shore up Medicaid some other way. I just don't see how that they can let these the kind of cuts that would be necessary if they don't do something happen. I mean, I think it was a good idea to tie the cigarette tax to Medicaid, but now that that's apparently not going to happen, you can't just not do anything else. They've got to come up with some other funding in some way.
And of course, a lot of the contention about this is that it gets back to accepting the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, whether you are expanding Sooner Care or Ensure Oklahoma versus actual Medicaid expansion in the state. From your sense of watching the legislature, how ingrained are a lot of members against expanding Medicaid in any form or way?
Well, I think there are quite a few that are very ingrained in that. I mean, you have the governor and basically every leader that's been bashing the Affordable Care Act for 5 or 6 years now. It's sort of hard to do an about face and, you know, sort of on a dime, so to speak, and all of a sudden decide that it's okay. You can't talk one way for years and then change easily. But and I think that's where they've got some separation between the membership and the leadership. The leaders, as you say, were ready to go, but they just couldn't bring people along.
Let me ask you about another criticism of this legislature. You know, they went into the session knowing they had this $1.3 billion shortfall. According to the leadership, they've been meeting in private to sort of hammer out an agreement, which still hasn't occurred. And what happened in the public forums of the legislature was an awful lot of work on sort of social, some people would might say dog whistle measures, everything from restrictions against the lesbian gay community in the state. Just yesterday, they passed the most restrictive abortion law. Most observers say it would be patently unconstitutional, but they passed that on the next last day of the session to consider revenue bills. They passed that resolution on impeaching the president over this transgender bathroom issue. Do you think some of the legislatures have missed the boat of what is important in this session?
Well, you know, of course, that depends on your point of view. It's sort of the era that we're living in. My point of view would be that I don't see a lot to be gained by passing bills that you know are not going to pass constitutional muster, but you know, politics. I mean, this is just the times we're in, and I think that it's not limited in Oklahoma. It's happening all over the country. People are frustrated, and they're making their statements about you know, where they stand, and there just seems to be a lack of willingness for people to give, you know, and to participate in some sort of a social compact that is agreed upon. And so right now it's tough being in public office right now, regardless of what your point of view is, I think.
My guest today is Steve Lewis, a former Oklahoma House Speaker of the House, a former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Oklahoma. He runs his own law firm. He's at the Capitol today, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Give us your sense of what's likely to come out of the legislature to balance a budget. They have to balance a budget by law. Do you think it'll require a special session to get there? Do you think they'll come together here over the weekend and come up with a package? And what is that package likely to look like in your view?
When you talk to members, they seem fairly optimistic. But then when you watch the votes occur, it just doesn't happen. To answer your question, I mean, I've been up and down. If you would have asked me a couple of days ago, I would have thought that there would be a special session for sure. This morning, I'm thinking that maybe they can patch something together. They're not going to get the job done like they would like to do, I think. They're going to end up with a lot of one-time revenues again, getting money from various revolving funds and a few tax enhancements. But they're going to end up with a pretty big package of bonds, I think, to get it done. To be honest about it, it's pretty difficult to get 75% of any group to agree to anything. And then when you throw the political philosophy in it and the ideology and so forth, and we're a lot of these people are 30 days in front of an election, it's about as difficult a situation as they can be in. I don't know if a special session would do any good or not. They probably would be better off to just do the best they can do and go home and face the music.
You mentioned a lot of one-time revenues. Do you think there'll be some serious cuts to things like education, corrections, health care? At one point, the governor was talking about holding those harmless in her sort of budget 2.0 speech. But are we looking at some serious cuts in those areas?
I don't see how we avoid them. Of course, the governor's 2.0 budget, I don't think too much of that has actually come to pass yet. So, as I said, you talk to some of the members that should know what they're talking about, and they're still optimistic that they can avoid a lot of draconian cuts. But when you take education, the health care authority, DHS, and corrections, that's most of the money. And if you're not going to cut them, you'd have unsustainable cuts in everything else. So that realistically, there's going to have to be probably some sort of cuts.
I want to ask you, your greatest legislative achievement when you were Speaker of the House was the passage of House Bill 1017, which was an important educational reform act. Three of the most important parts have and are eroding: smaller class size, more funding for education and early childhood education, among others. What is your sense as you watch, you know, school districts preparing for draconian cuts, considering four-day school weeks? What is your own sense of this?
Just personally, you know, it makes you feel like you've lived too long. you live long enough to see what you thought were some answers turn out not to be answers. You know, I think it's really a shame that we are where we are with public education. There are a lot of reasons for it, but I don't think we the people can let ourselves off the hook. I remember back in the days of 1017, the legislature then was responding to quite a movement on the part of the people themselves. The education community was up in arms, the business community. I think one difference between now and then was that even your business leaders in that time were really, really hurting. I mean, the people that had been doing very well for a very, very long time, or even born that way, losing a lot, if not everything, and everyone was of the opinion that something had to be done and that the answer was to fix the education system. And that made it doable, made it possible to get something like 1017 to happen. I don't know that there's that kind of a consensus among our people in the public right now. We're looking for answers that are probably not really answers. And so until we make the demand, you know, people that are in public office usually are well-intended and they want to do what the people want them to do, but I think the folks that are now there believe they're doing what the people want them to do, and unless they hear a different message, it's not going to really change.
Steve Lewis, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Lewis is a former Speaker of the Oklahoma State House from 1989 to 1993 and a former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Oklahoma. He joined us from the Capitol. Religious leaders have been front and center during this legislative session, urging legislators to avoid balancing the state budget on the backs of those who are least able to afford it. Late last night or early this morning, the State House passed a measure which now goes to the governor for her signature that has been symbolic of this conflict. It repeals the refundable portion of the Oklahoma Earned Income Tax Credit. It doesn't save the state a lot of money, about $20 to $30 million, and frankly only provides a token payment of $200 to $300 per individual. But it has assumed greater importance over who's responsible for the social safety net in the state. Government, or as some legislators have suggested, private charity and religious organizations. Joining me today is the Reverend Dr. William Tabernay, the Executive Director of the Oklahoma Conference of Churches and a former president of Phillips Theological Seminary here in Tulsa. Dr. Tabernay, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
The Oklahoma Conference of Churches has been really highly visible and affiliated organizations with the conference during this legislative session because of the $1.3 billion shortfall. Your affiliated groups have wanted the legislature to know that they really can't balance the budget on the backs of the most vulnerable populations.
Exactly.
And early this morning or late last night, depending on your viewpoint, the House did pass changes to the Earned Income Tax Credit here in Oklahoma. It will save about $29 million. It's going to the governor for her signature. What was your reaction to this particular budget change?
Very disappointed, because obviously there is a need to balance the budget, and we applaud the legislators for trying their very best to do so. But it seems to us to be very unfair to try to balance the budget on the backs of the poor. I've heard people say that everybody has to do their fair share, but when there are people who don't have a fair share in the first place, it's very difficult for them to bear the burdens which could be borne in other ways.
Now, I know you've probably been talking to a number of legislators. Why this particular route? You know, the governor earlier on in the session said repealing the latest income tax cut, which saves about $175 million, was a drop in the bucket. Yet this small measure only saves about $29 million.
Right. And that's the strange thing about it, because it seems to me that there are much better options, and we can talk about those, although it may be too late to talk about some of those. And I think the principle or the policy behind it seems to be, at least from some legislators, that churches and religious groups should take care of the poor, and they can, in terms of the state, pass off those responsibilities. And we would want to argue that that isn't the case, that in fact it should be a partnership between the church and the state in terms of helping the poor. For instance, I was shocked by a statement made by one of the senators which said it's about time that the churches stepped up, and if the churches were doing what they were supposed to be doing, then we wouldn't be having this debate.
I believe the actual quote was, you need to get off your butts.
Right. Well, I wanted to be more polite than that reporting that, but you know, what does he think the churches have been doing for all those years and centuries? And the churches, in fact, do bear a great responsibility, and gladly so, for taking care of the poor, working with other non-profits like the Alliance, the Homeless Alliance, and Feed the Children, and Food Bank, and a whole lot of groups like that, as well as each individual congregation helping where they can. What surprises me, again, with those sort of statements, is that there seems to be a fallacy in terms of the logic, because the figures just don't seem to add up. When you say we're going to save $28, $29 million to help plug the deficit, that seems, again, to be a relatively small amount. As I said, there are other ways where that could have been plugged by almost the same amount, like the subsidy that is still going to be given for unproductive oil wells, for example. Now, that's been capped at $25 million, but that is still almost the same amount of money as they're going to save by taking this money for the poor. But for the churches, who are already doing such a great job in helping the poor, for the churches to raise an additional $28 or $29 million is a huge step.
Well, I want to ask you the thought process behind that sort of feeling. I'm wondering how widespread that's held at the legislature, because that seems just to be a complete abdication of the social safety net, which we think of since at least the 1930s, at the very least, as a responsibility of government.
Exactly. And it seems to me that there has been a real change in the ideology over the last few years. It's a very surprising turnaround, and it seems to be driven by fiscal reasons, that if you need a justification, then maybe by changing the principles by which you work gives you the justification, and saying, well, we won't have a social safety net anymore, which used to be a bipartisan philosophy, and the earned income tax credit was very much bipartisan. But we've seen this happen in a number of other ways. And again, the churches and the other faith groups are very willing to participate and to work jointly. But there is an initiative that Governor Fallon started a little while ago and is almost coming to the end now, but it's called Oklahoma Fosters. And there's a huge need for more foster families. And so we're very supportive of what they're doing. But it still, at the same time, has a little of that philosophy behind it, that the church really needs to do it because the state can't.
Now, I know you've been talking to legislators and religious groups and ministers associated with your group have been talking to the legislators throughout the session. It is a tough session for legislators, $1.3 billion.
Sure.
Where would you like to see either revenue enhancements or cuts focused?
As I said, first of all, in terms of oil producers, now this would be a huge change, but you probably know that when new wells start, there is an incentive, and that production is taxed at 1%. And then after 5 years or maybe 3 years, I'm not sure, it goes to 3%, and it's still a very low percentage of income that is derived from all of this. Even raising all of that by 1% or 2% would end up producing as much income as they're trying to save through the cutting or reduction of the earned income tax credit.
Well, it's interesting, the marginal wells, which you alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. they're taxed at 7%.
Right.
Which seems like, for a very small oil producer, that seems incredibly unfair when you have large producers that are paying 1% or 2%.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. And then the other way to do it, obviously, is that there is the general tax cut that was implemented, and lots of people have been arguing, well, why don't we not implement that proposed tax cut? Or at least one other option would be to eliminate that tax credit and cut for incomes over $200,000. We've been talking about people whose income is about $20,000, who are not able to afford that sort of a cut because they're still paying the same state sales tax. They're still paying all the other taxes as people do who are earning $200,000 or more. And if we were to eliminate the tax cuts that have been proposed and have not been withdrawn only on people who are earning $200,000 or more, you are saving probably double what this earned income tax credit reduction would be earning. So that would be another way.
When you look at a lot of the ideas out there, they do disproportionately hurt the poor. You're looking at everything from a general sales tax increase.
Right.
The cigarette tax, although it failed, it's right. probably going to come up, and it probably needs to come up because that's the funding mechanism
yes.
to preserve Medicaid in the state.
Exactly.
But that tax disproportionately hurts the poor because smoking rates are higher among the poor. So you see a whole bunch of items lined up that affects disproportionately the poor in raising revenue.
And that's why we as churches and the heads of churches are so opposed to this, because it is not just unfair. We think in our view it is immoral to do that, because the poor are the ones who ought to be protected. And what seems so strange to me is, you know, we're talking in this particular instance about the earned income tax credit for the working poor. I mean, we're not talking about the indigent or the destitute. We are talking about hard-working people, very often single mothers with children, who are earning a minimum wage, which has not been increased for a long time and is, in fact, inadequate, so that these people who are trying so hard, even trying as hard as they do, can only live at the margins of the poverty rate and sort of perhaps just under that poverty line. And the whole idea behind these earned income tax credits in the first place was just to give them a little bit of help to enable them to stay in the system and not drop out into homelessness and even worse situations. And what to me is so surprising is that for families that earn, say, $20,000 or less, the saving is really only $231, and for $27,000 income, it's about $241 that the state saves. And to many people, that's a very small amount in terms of the $231 or $241, but it makes a real difference for people who don't have very much money at all. And so even that little bit of money is crucial to keeping them working.
The Reverend Dr. William Tabernay is the Executive Director of the Oklahoma Conference of Churches. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.